Hotel Check-In.
Well, tonight we are going to check into a sprawling white hotel on the Great Western Highway in the Blue Mountains in New South Wales. You might have seen it from the road if you've driven up that way, or even glimpsed its grand form on the escarpment from far below in the Megalong Valley. This white building that glows in the afternoon sunlight has had a colourful history since its opening as a health retreat in 1904 during a snowstorm. Believe it or not, the Hydro Majestic had electricity 4 days before the city of Sydney. And the hotel's history is really also the story of one of the most fascinating and eclectic people in Australian history, a dashing retail baron called Mark Foy. Well, to tell us the story of the Hydro Majestic Hotel in the Blue Mountains and its creator, Mark Foy, my guest on Hotel Check-In is Perry Prince, who is a film director from Turning Point Films and has made a film about the hotel and its history. Hi, Perry. Welcome to Nightlife.
Hi.
Have you stayed in the Hydro Majestic yourself?
Yes, I absolutely have stayed there. I even stayed there once for the day by myself when it was in the middle of one of its renovation periods. So I was the only person there, and it was a little bit spooky because it's a very, very big old hotel.
Why did you stay there yourself in the middle of the renovation? Was that something to do with the film?
Yes, I was through all the old ledges and it was very windy and very cold, and I was given the keys to the kingdom, and it was really quite an experience, but it was wonderful going through the registers.
Just introduce us to Mark Foy. I'm sure many Sydneysiders will have heard of him, but maybe not people in the rest of the country. Who was he?
Oh, look, he was just, I'm a little bit in love with Mark Foy because he's just so fabulous and so eccentric and spontaneous, and he really just did live as he pleased. And what people, I think, don't realise is that Mark Foy's retail empire, for want of a better word, was really named after their father. The whole family is fascinating. And Mark Foy Sr. came out from Ireland during the gold rush, trying to, you know, get ahead. And he wasn't doing terribly well on the gold fields in Bendigo, he started. And so he used some of his old skills of drapery from Ireland and started selling goods to the miners' wives. And this is where he started to do really well. It wasn't long before he had 6 stores in Collingwood. And his two, he had several children, but the eldest was Francis Foy. And then Mark was the first Foy born here, born in Bendigo. So of this Foy family. So, their retailing outlets were actually named after their father, Mark Foy Sr. But, of course, Mark being the second child, he got all the limelight for it. And I think he was quite happy with that.
So eventually the family moved to Sydney, and Mark Foy ended up, I think, with Francis setting up this amazing sort of retail empire, which netted them quite a bit of wealth, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. They were very canny, very clever, which they got from their father. You know, they had this thing in Ireland where they would have a fair, very big on advertising. And when they left Melbourne, they actually left Melbourne because it's a long story, but the Victorian people would know Gibson, Foy and Gibson. And so they had brought in a partner called Gibson, and Gibson and Francis, who was the eldest, were not getting along. So they parted ways, and Francis came up to Sydney and brought Mark with him, and that's when the two brothers went into partnership together. But they had a fair here, big opening day, and they did a letterbox drop, which had never been done in Sydney before, and, you know, come to the fair and it's going to be this, that, and the other, and they had all their store absolutely bursting at the seams with stock. Well, Sydneysiders didn't know what that meant. They thought it was an exchange fair or something like that, so they chickens and animals to sell. And when they got there, the street was absolutely packed. The police had to come. There was livestock. There were people everywhere, complete confusion. But Francis somehow pulled the group together and was able to say, look, it's all happening inside. It's happening in this store. And everyone had a good laugh and calmed down. And by the afternoon, Francis had to send younger brother Mark out to all the other stores to buy their stuff to go back and put it into their shop so they could keep selling. They were just sold out. The shelves were pretty well empty by the afternoon. Wow. So that was their introduction.
This is Perry. It's Australia in the late 1890s. There was a lot of money around, wasn't there? And a kind of growing middle class who had plenty of money to burn.
That's right. Yeah. And they really were, you know, around the world, retailing was really sort of becoming an event. You know, women were starting to go from the cotton and everything that was taking off in America, it grew into these products. And then women were starting to enjoy shopping. It was aimed at women who would go and spend their time there. And there were always cafes and different things included. And so it, you know, it became a lovely place to go and visit and look at these wares. And Mark and Frances were right onto it. Mark had seen a lot of it. Their father had actually died in San Francisco. And Mark had gone over to see his father. And even back then, that was in 1884, Mark was even then picking up on all these new trends and things and bringing them back to Sydney and saying, this is the way we've got to go. You know, this is a really big deal. So that's what they were doing. They were bringing, you know, this wonderful event to shoppers, to consumers.
You're doing a hotel check-in on Nightlife with me, Suzanne Hill. My guest is Perry Prince, who's a documentary director who directed this documentary called The Jewel of the Mountains. And Perry, we'd better get to the jewel itself, which is today the Hydro Majestic Hotel. So what made Mark Foy go, I'm going to build a hotel in the Blue Mountains?
Well, there was a bit of contention between him and Frances over this, because a lot of the relatives were coming out from Ireland to join this thriving business, this retail business. And Frances said, look, we need to put our eggs in a few baskets here. The business can't support everybody. So why don't we get into a few hotels? He had some family that were doing well in some hotels. And so Mark said, well, that's a good idea. But Mark, being the more extravagant and flamboyant, said, look, let's not just go with a couple of simple hotels. All the rage right now, these hydropathic spas, you know, he'd stayed in them overseas. Let's build one of those. And Frances said, oh, look, that's just a bit too over the top for me. But Mark had, by then, he had set his heart on it. So he went up to the Blue Mountains, which was known then around the world to apparently have the purest air anywhere. And he went up there and bought three properties together and started to join them together. So there was a beautiful hotel up there called the Belgravia Hotel. He joined that to another property, and then in a long corridors, and then bought another property. And between them, he built this beautiful Hydro Majestic, which ended up being, it's a kilometre long up there. So it's a real serpentine kind of building on a cliff face, which you could never get away with today, but it's spectacular, of course. It is.
Now, I love this because he wanted the idea of the bath to be, you know, very prominent. He actually made the town of Medlow change its name to Medlow Bath.
Yes, he did, yes, because he first of all, he thought there was some springs, some natural springs up there, but after he bought it, he realised that was just rumour. So then he thought, well, I'll still change it to Medlow Bath anyway, and that will, you know, that will bring people in thinking there are springs there. But I think whatever springs were there, they had well and truly dried up by 1904, which was when he opened it. So, yeah, so he had water imported from overseas, actually, spa water imported from overseas.
So when the building opened, it was actually very technically unique and quite advanced, wasn't it? This was in 1904.
He opened it on the 4th of July because he was mad keen on everything American. And he had the first cars in the country. He imported the first cars in. He organised for a fleet of cars from Penrith Station to come up the mountain, which would have been, you know, no proper roads. Everybody went by train then. So these were really outback sort of roads, and they made the trip for the opening. But he had an internal phone system, which a lot of people would never have seen before, and he did have electricity before Sydney. How he organised these things, I don't know, but he wanted the best of everything, and he just found a way to find it. You know, not that he wasn't smart with his, you know, with purchasing things. He had gone to that beautiful Chicago White City Fair, I think, in 1893, and domes were a really big deal back then. And he had a dome made in Chicago and dismantled and then brought it over here and set it up. And the dome became the centrepiece of the Hydro. And he initially put a big spotlight in that, which helped his his patrons find their way to it, I think, in the middle of the snow.
Because, yeah. I mean, you mentioned that they've caught the train to Penrith and had to go up, but it was a blizzard as well to top everything off.
That particular night was one of the worst blizzards they've ever had. So they were in open top, you know, little cars. So they were rugged up to the hilt with hats and whatever. And you can imagine going through the bush, completely isolated in this crazy bush and snow, and then there's this giant spotlight. And before your eyes in the glistening snow is this incredible long white building with Mark Foy and his champagne standing out the front to welcome you into the big fireplace.
What an incredible adventure. I can just imagine being someone in that car, one of those cars on the way to this opening. How amazing. Now, when this health spa was set up, I mean, it really was, you know, you had the first night where you got your champagne after you'd driven through the blizzard. But after that, you were meant to actually be very healthy if you went up to the hotel, didn't you?
Yeah. I've heard a lot of people say he was a hypochondriac, and you know, academics say that, and that could be right, but he was a health fanatic. I know that from family members, you know, right through his life. So he would have loved this period, you know, the wellness period we're in now. He really believed in those things, and he did stay in spas to feel better, and he felt better and was healed of certain complaints, but they were tough. That was no picnic going up there. And some people just found it quite confronting, some of the gadgets and machinery and devices you had to step into and you were kind of contained in while you were squirted with hot water, near boiling water, and all sorts of mustard pastes and, all kind of things. Another thing they had was two separate areas for the nude sunbathing. So there was the male and the female nude sunbathing.
That was the sun bath, yes, as opposed to the other baths.
In the sun, so all sorts of different things they had going on, lots of contraptions where you were really captured up to your neck and had to be released from things as all sorts of steam and, you know, things were entering your body.
How absolutely bizarre. And then after all that, you couldn't even recover with a glass of something alcoholic. No. That was banned, right?
Yep. Banned, absolutely. It was all very healthy food, and you had to drink this endless spa water, which was shipped out, I think, from Germany, unfortunately in copper barrels, which tended to corrode, and so it wasn't a terribly nice tasting water, but Mark Foy swore by it. So that was the beverage that went with that delightful trip, yeah.
Wow. Now, I understand that Mark Foy also had a farm down in the Megalong Valley, and he had a flying fox built to send the food back up to the hotel.
He did. And that was brilliant. So when you think about it, the hydro was self-sustained. He grew all their own food down there, all their vegetables and their meat, and the farm was quite a big parcel of land. And so, yes, the flying fox had to traverse the cliff to get the food there and back, and the scraps were sent back as well. And the person in charge of that was a fellow called Louis Gaumont, a Chinese man who was one of Mark's closest friends. His nickname was Charlie, and he was the cook. He oversaw that job, which was really a big responsibility considering all the guests that they had.
So initially, Perry, the hotel was the Medlow Bath, and then it became the Hydro Majestic. When did that transformation take place?
Probably around about 1910. He came in a bit late, to be honest. 1904 was just on the end of this hydropathic phase. So he sort of came in a bit late, and then Australians were not really ready for this invasive sort of program that was offered. And while it was a bit of a novelty to start, they weren't really supporting it. So by about 1910, he'd started to rethink things and said, look, you know, we need to sort of make this more family. And I think champagne came back on the menu, and then they were into the shows, and they had that beautiful casino room there under the dome, and they had a lot of performances there. And so, it really became a lot more fashionable. And that's what I would say were the glory days when the big stars came. And
well, you better tell us about who some of those big stars were then, who visited it.
Pretty well anyone who was travelling through. I mean, Dame Nellie Melba was a regular, and Arthur Conan Doyle of Sherlock Holmes. He stayed there, and Clara Butt stayed there, and the Pathé brothers, you know, with the brothers from France, Lottie Lyle and Raymond Longford, they shot the Blue Mountains Mystery there together, and there's photos up at the Hydro of them filming in the dining room up there. Edmund Barton stayed there frequently, our first Prime Minister. Pretty well anyone that wanted to be seen. It was a pretty impressive roll call. A few that were secret that wouldn't leave their names in the register, but pretty well anyone who went through stayed there.
Now, I when I watched the documentary, Perry, I loved the bit where, and maybe this is a little bit later in its history, but on Saturday nights, people would perhaps be at the hotel having illicit affairs. And so if you wanted to steal a car, that was the night to do it, wasn't it?
Yes, that was more around about the 70s, I think, it was so far from Sydney. You know, you could get away with things like that. So there was a rumour amongst the thieves up there that if you wanted to steal a car, you would go there on that Saturday night because no one would put you in. You could get away with it because they weren't about to try and start any investigation. They all had to get back to their significant others back in Sydney.
Yes, didn't want to have to answer any awkward questions, did they?
That's right.
Now, there were some, as well as some famous guests, there were also some famous deaths at the hotel. Now, you just mentioned our first Prime Minister, Edmund Barton. He died at the hotel.
He did. He died in the bath. His wife was out there outside the room and the doctor was called, and that's all written up in the papers. And so, yeah, that's really, you know, quite significant. He loved going up there. But there was also one of the staffers there, a lovely young girl. She was being stalked by one of her previous lovers. And yes, he came along to say, "Can I see you?" And somebody said, "Look, we'll come with you." And she said, no, it'll be fine." And they went around towards the station, towards a Medlow Bar station, and he did kill her there. And I know that Mark Foy was very distraught about that because, you know, he felt that someone should have been with her and looking after her. And there was another, I think, during one of the renovation periods early on, there was some Florence Lusted went missing. We know that Mr. Lusted was one of the workers there and there'd been some problems in their marriage. So, you know, there was rumour there that she'd been done away with, but she's never been found since. So we don't know.
Gosh, we don't know. Still a mystery. Yeah, Perry Prince is with me. She's the documentary director of The Jewel of the Mountains, which is all about the Hydro Majestic Hotel, which is what we're talking about in tonight's edition of Hotel Check-In. Just before we move forward into more modern times, Perry, back in the early days, there was this part of the building that was called the Cat's Alley. What was the Cat's Alley?
Well, I mean, you could never get away with this today, of course, but the Cat's Alley, it was initially called the Cloisters, and then it's a long, long corridor. Everyone that goes to the Hydro knows Cat's Alley. It's always been very, very popular. But back then, the men used to play billiards. There was the billiard room there, and they had two or three enormous billiard tables, and the men would play billiards, and the women would wait for them in this long, long corridor that eventually became known as Cat's Alley because there was so much gossip that went on, bearing in mind that a lot of men had their mistresses there and, you know, there were women there that were only the mountains women, whereas the Sydney women might have been kept separate. So, you know, there was always a lot of gossip, a lot of story, and that became, you know, a place of champagne and jewels and gossip and was definitely known as Cat's Alley and is still known as Cat's Alley. It's really quite lovely.
And is this right, Perry, that also in the early days there was a mobile confessional booth so that if you'd done something wrong, you could go and confess your sins on the spot?
Yes, there was. I believe that's still there. I think that's still there. But yes.
Used it last time you were there, did you, Perry?
I did. Just on that long day I was there by myself, I thought I'd take advantage of it.
Let's go to 1922 because the building was partly destroyed in a fire. What happened to the hotel then?
As time went on, you know, Mark spent a lot of time overseas. He was living in America then. He would come back and forth. And in a strange way, the Hydro always sort of reflected Mark. So when Mark was in it, it was full of life. Everywhere Mark went, it was full of life and everything thrived and did well. And when Mark wasn't there, things sort of fell a little bit into disrepair. And 1922 was a period when he was living in America. I think his wife was here at that time and still in Sydney, but only on a visit. She was living with him. And word came to him that the fire had happened in 1922. Fortunately, there was only the caretaker and his family sleeping in there at that time. It was closed for the winter. It was significantly destroyed. The long corridors that joined the original Belgravia to the main hotel were full of priceless art and statues, and they were all destroyed. And the big main Belgravia entrance was completely destroyed. So what's interesting is that Medlow Bath itself was in mourning. They really treated this building as precious to them, something of real pride. And they loved Mark Foy and they called him the father of Medlow Bath, they used to call him. Everyone was in mourning. Everybody was in mourning for what had been done. And at that point, Mark almost sold it. He did put it up to auction but I think it was in such a state he didn't get any bids. And in a way, Mark was kind of pleased because I think he wanted to refurbish it and move on. So that's what they did.
Now, Perry, we've spent so much time talking about all the early parts of this story that we're starting to run short of time. So I might just get you to take us through a bit of a quite potted history of the rest of its story, because, you know, it changed hands. It became a base to Americans during World War II. Can you just sort of give us a very brief history of the rest of the last century?
Yeah, well, I'll do my best. After the fire and after they rebuilt it, they used a lot of the Art Deco period. And then I think it was around about that time that Mark had said, that's it, it's staying with our family forever. However, it's a very expensive building to run. And after quite a while, I think it was in the 1980s, it eventually sold outside of the family. So it was with the family up until the 80s. Oh, I meant to say too, in World War II, the American Army took over and it became a hospital. So one of the Foy family then at that time only had a week to clear everything out so it would be available to the American Army. So after that, it was closed for 6 months and fell into a lot of disrepair. And then they opened it again. And then in 1984, they did sell it outside the family. And then it sold again in 1996. And then it sold again in 2008 to the current owners. And I really want to pay tribute to the current owners because they brought back a lot of Mark Foy's original plans, his actual drawings, and some of the things that he didn't ever finish, including the winter garden, which we have pictures of that he drew and was never able to be implemented during his lifetime. So they have stayed true to his original design, and it is just beautiful because the history is there and it's all sort of reborn, and it's just a beautiful tribute to its history and to Mark.
And so when you go there today, you're looking at a lot of the original ideas that Mark Foy had that have been brought back to life again?
Absolutely. And they've done different to sort of honour the periods that it's been through. They have different time periods as well. So Cat's Alley now has got a lovely Asian feel to it because there was a period when Mark Foy was very taken with everything Asian. He had a lot of Asian influence in his life. He had Asian nannies. And so they've sort of done that there. And then the winter garden is almost to the original plan. It's beautiful, bright and yellows, and takes in that spectacular view of the Megalong Valley. And then the Belgravia wing is kind of a nod to the 40s and the chrome. And, you know, and then you've got the Art Deco, which is influenced all the way through from the 20s. So they've really done a terrific job. Peter Reeve was the designer, and he really has done a spectacular job in honouring every period of that building and its history, and you know, all so many lovely cheeky nods to Mark, which is lovely.
Mark just sounds like such an amazing man, Perry. When I was watching the documentary, I just thought, I've seen the Mark Foy's, I think this is still a sign somewhere around in Sydney, but I've seen it. I've never really knew this much about him, but what a character.
Oh, he was an amazing character. And Mark Foy's now is the courthouse in Sydney, so you'll see it on the news every week. You'll see the old Mark Foy's, and it's still got the signage on there, that, you know, ladies' underwear, and they've left all that there on the outside signage. But the other great love of Mark Foy's life was the Sydney Flying Squadron, which is an open boat club which still runs out of Kirribilli. He is still revered, and his picture is still up in the wall there at the clubhouse. And that is a beautiful little sailing club of the 18-footers, which he invented. And Mark Foy also invented the handicap system. It was initially called the Mark Foy system. So this was all part of racing. He was very sporty, very athletic, and very, very healthy. So he absolutely loved the sailing club. And that's still for people to enjoy.
Yeah, lots of tributes to his life still today that you can see. Perry, thank you so much for joining us. And if our listeners want to find out a little bit more about the hotel, the film is called The Jewel of the Mountains.
Yes, and you're more than welcome. I could talk about him for probably another 3 hours or 3 hours.
All right, well, maybe another time. Hey, Perry, thanks so much for joining us on a hotel check-in tonight.
No problem. Thank you.
That is Perry Prince. Perry is the director of the film The Jewel of the Mountains, which tells the story of the Hydro Majestic Hotel.